From the Sky News Centre at 5, a police officer who posted offensive messages on Twitter about the death of Baroness Thatcher has quit his job at the Metropolitan Police. Scotland Yard confirmed it has accepted Sergeant Jeremy Scott's resignation with immediate effect. A former winner of The Apprentice has lost her claim of constructive dismissal against Lord Sugar. Stella English took a case against the Labour peer after quitting her job at his company, claiming she was treated like an overpaid lackey, something he denied. The tribunal panel dismissed her claim. Lord Sugar says that was always the right decision.
We're obviously very pleased that the tribunal found in our favour. We're not surprised. I think the judgment that was written says it all, really. I mean, the case should never have been brought.
A man starting an 18-year jail term after admitting slashing women with a blade at random. Sasha Masamba from Hounslow left two victims with permanent scars around their face and neck. The judge said the 21-year-old was particularly dangerous because there was no motive. Detective Chief Inspector Amanda Hargreaves agrees.
I think it reflects the serious nature of the crimes that he committed. These attacks were very worrying. It was on two lone females late at night, completely unprovoked, random. I strongly believe if we hadn't have caught him when we did, he would have gone on to commit other offences.
The US Secretary of State has said America is prepared to defend itself and its allies against any nuclear threat from North Korea. Speaking in the South Korean capital, Seoul, John Kerry said it would be a huge mistake for the North to carry out its threat to launch a missile. David Cameron is travelling to Germany this evening. He's trying to convince Chancellor Angela Merkel that his plans to reform the EU will benefit Europe as a whole. That's the latest. I'm Barry Weir.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Helping us review this week's news is Liberal Democrat MEP for the South West of England, Sir Graham Watson. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, well, Bristol tops international news bulletins with its spontaneous Monday night party. Several arrests but no injuries. From 1979 to 1990, the Thatcher legacy, Tory versus Labour view. We go back over the high spots or low spots of the Thatcher years and gauge her effect on us now in 2013. Plus, fracking in the Mendips, where much of our water comes from, hydraulic fracturing in the Earth's crust, releasing, amongst other things, gas. Or is it an attempt to make all natural water undrinkable? This week saw the release of Durham University's report, which gives fracking a clean bill of health. Only trouble is, it's written by a former expert from ExxonMobil, Professor Richard Davis. Plus, next weekend, we'll see Bristol's annual Anarchist Book Fair. Will it simply be a festival of lawlessness and subversion? Or do Bristol's anarchists have a point? And James Steele, America's mystery man in Iraq. This shocking BBC documentary showing torture and murder of prisoners of war, sanctioned right from the top, was made for the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War last month, but it still hasn't been shown on BBC terrestrial television. Plus, a top Italian judge, he accuses Ken Clark's secret Bilderberg Club of being behind decades of terrorism in Europe. Bilderberg was started by a former SS officer. Top BBC manager Marcus Aegeus is a member. And the latest leak suggests the Bilderberg may be meeting near London next month in Britain for the first time in 15 years. Plus, Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Don't know where the weather forecast is. Seems to have disappeared, but we'll have that in a little while. But first, reviewing this week's news is Liberal Democrat MEP for the South West of England, Sir Graham Watson. Hi, Sir Graham, and welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Now, first of all, the EU anyway, is not getting a very good press at the moment, particularly because of the euro crisis. Everybody, it seems, is at the behest of the European Central Bank, having to pay back massive amounts of money right across Europe, particularly the poorer countries in southern Europe. And so you're not really flavour of the month right now, are you?
No, we're not. We're in a recession. Everybody knows it. People are suffering, people are losing their jobs or their jobs are at risk of being lost. And of course government gets the blame, and the further away the government is from the people, the easier it is to knock it. But I think that actually it's the fact that we have a European single currency and a European single bank that actually prevented the whole of the European Union being blown apart when Lehman Brothers collapsed back in 2008.
I mean, wouldn't it be better just to allow Lehman Brothers to collapse and allow these bankrupt banks to actually go bankrupt? Much easier than to start again, isn't it?
There's a very, very good case for avoiding what's called moral hazard, in other words, for letting banks go bankrupt. But of course, as we saw with our own Northern Rock, if what's at stake is the savings of hundreds of thousands of ordinary people, then government has to act.
Okay, Cyprus, this is the latest in a series, and it doesn't seem there's going to be any end to this. It seems to be getting worse and worse treatment for countries around, particularly around southern Europe. The Icelandics seem to have managed to dodge it, being away from the EU, the Norwegians as well. You know, a lot of these people are thinking, well, we're glad we're nothing to do with the EU, and we're nothing to do particularly with the euro. But in the case of Cyprus, I mean, you know, you look around this, it's almost as if it's a tiny little country that's just been picked off because it's easy to get at. There's also the fact, a bit like the Falkland Islands, that off the coast of Cyprus is what it's really all about. That's natural gas resources and petrochemicals.
I think the people of Cyprus have been let down very badly by their own governments over a number of years, and particularly by the last government, which took massive loans from Moscow that it was never going to be able to pay back. And in fact, this crisis, this recent one, started because they were unable to meet the payments on their loans from Moscow. And what's happening is that they are having to make a special tax on all of the very wealthy people with investments in Cyprus banks. In other words, if you've got over 100,000 euros, which is over about £95,000, you're going to have to pay a special tax. What they really need is a responsible government that'll manage the country's economy properly in the future.
But the people of Cyprus aren't necessarily blaming their government, are they? They're blaming the fact that they're tied into this European euro system. If they weren't, they'd be fine.
No, they wouldn't be fine at all. If they weren't, they'd be bankrupt. And they'd probably be in a worse situation than they are. What's happening is they're getting a 10 billion euro loan from the European Union, mainly paid by Germany, simply because they're a member of the European Union.
But they won't be able to pay it back.
Well, they will be able to pay it back, and they'll be given a very long period in which to pay it back. But if they hadn't been in the European Union, what would have happened? The Russians would have come in and said, well, you can't pay your debts. We're going to take your oil and gas reserves. That wouldn't have been very popular either, would it?
But as it is, it looks like the big Western European oil companies are going to be taking those gas reserves.
We don't yet know, because the auctions haven't been carried out, who is going to be selected to develop the oil and gas reserves. My own view, frankly, is that if you're an island like Cyprus, you'd be far better off exploiting renewable energy of sun and wind and not going down the oil route at all, because as so many countries that have big reserves of oil know, you simply get used as a pawn for all of the world's big financiers.
Now, you sit in the European Parliament. Give us an idea of how often the Parliament sits, whether it's sitting at the moment, for example, and what your role is as an MEP.
Well, we meet every week. In fact, I flew back into the UK from Brussels this morning. My role is very similar to that of an MP at Westminster. I sit in a Parliament that has a certain amount of powers. We have in the European Union a bicameral legislature. You have two houses of parliament. The nearest equivalent, the House of Commons, is actually the Council of Ministers. It's sometimes one agriculture minister from every member country or one transport minister, but they're the people who can take the initiative for legislation. The European Parliament's a bit more like the House of Lords. We're a revising chamber, but we've got more teeth than the House of Lords have got. They have to reach agreement with us. We can't start legislation, but we can stop them doing things we think are wrong. And then you have the European Commission, which is a civil service, and a European Court of Justice, and a Court of Auditors, and all the things that you need when you are trying to manage a society of 500 million people.
Now, you mentioned the auditors. The European Union's accounts haven't been audited, have they, for something like 15 years?
Well, no. They've been audited every year, and thanks to action in the European Parliament, we oblige the Court of Auditors to publish their report, and we have a debate with them every year. It's not they haven't been audited, it's that under parts of the treaties, the auditors are not allowed to inspect the books of national governments through which the money is spent. And so it's a technical reason. We say, well, how can we sign off the accounts if we're not allowed to inspect the books? It's unlike the situation in the UK, where the accounts of the Department of Work and Pensions have been signed off for almost 20 years because there are serious errors in it. They're not serious errors in the case of Brussels, it's just that the auditors are not allowed to look at the things that they should be allowed to look at by the national governments.
Now, if we vote for you as an MEP or any other MEP, what's the point? Because if you can't actually bring in changes, if you can't bring in new laws, legislation, what's the point in voting for you?
Oh, we can bring in lots of legislation, but we're not the ones who can take the initiative. What we can do, though, and what we frequently do...
Well, you're on the back foot the whole time then, aren't you? I mean, surely, you know, you've got to be able to be, as an MEP, proactive, say, actually, we need to do this and to change things.
Well, you can be proactive, and there are things, for example, if you take something like the European Arrest Warrant, which is the most effective tool we have in the fight against terrorism. I was the person who proposed that in a report in the European Parliament. It was later taken up by the governments and then became law. But of course, it's true, they didn't have to take it up. I proposed it because I thought it was necessary, but it was up to the governments to decide whether to take it up. And that's the way it should be. You know, the European Union is a union of 27 countries, but it's run by the national governments because they are the people who we elect directly.
Now, you mentioned the European Arrest Warrant. That's an incredibly controversial bit of law. I'm surprised if you confessing to putting your name to it, because, for example, you know, you can actually get somebody arrested in another part of Europe when you haven't even got the evidence to charge them. You haven't actually got enough evidence together.
No, that's not true at all. The European Arrest Warrant is a warrant which says that if in any country a warrant is issued for the arrest of somebody suspected of a serious crime, then the police in every country have to help find that person and return them to put them on trial. Nobody is arguing that you should have people arrested with no evidence against them. There have been problems
not enough to charge them.
Well, there have been one or two problems with the way it's been implemented in the United Kingdom, but if we did put it into national law in the way the Germans did, we wouldn't have had those problems, and I'm pleased to see that the current government is actually reviewing this and is changing the implementing provisions. In other words, we will no longer extradite people unless we are clear that there is a solid body of evidence against them.
So am I right in thinking that it's this piece of legislation, your legislation, that means that Julian Assange is now incarcerated in the Ecuadorian embassy in London?
No, it's not. That's not to do with the European arrest warrant.
It wasn't. The European arrest warrant was issued by the Swedish authorities for him.
It was, but it's not actually the case for his incarceration. Look, you can think what you like about Julian Assange. What he has done, which I think, and I think many people think is good, is to publish cables that were otherwise secret that show government wrongdoing. But what he's charged with here are some quite serious sexual offences against women. And I believe he should face trial, and if he's innocent, then he will be no doubt set free.
One of the points that has been made in his favour is particularly concerning, is that this woman who's accused him of rape then went out partying with him other nights and was being very friendly with him.
There's not only one woman who's accused him of rape, there are multiple accusations.
There are
at least two.
And one of them is having very much second thoughts about whether maybe she's been bamboozled into this. But anyway, you know, there are all sorts of questions about, you know, is it a good idea for someone to be extradited right across the continent for something which they have not even been charged with?
Well, in fact, he has been. Well, the Swedes have asked for his extradition because they have the evidence to charge him, and no doubt if he is extradited, that will be the reason. Look, I think this is important because the reality is you can go to just about any country, commit a crime, jump on a Ryanair plane home, and believe you can get away scot-free. That shouldn't be the case. There are serious crimes. This is only an arrest warrant for the most serious crimes. It's things like murder, rape, grievous bodily harm, terrorism. And if it hadn't been for the European arrest warrant, we would never have got the London bomber, Hussein Osman, back from Rome to stand trial here. We used that European arrest warrant 145 times last year to bring serious criminals back to this country. And that's one of the ways you can help keep people safe, because a criminal can be halfway across Europe before the policeman has got his boots on.
Okay. Now, you take a role in the wider Liberal Democrat groups in Europe. Tell us about that.
I was the leader of the Liberal Democrats in the European Parliament from 2002 to 2009.
Now, how many of them are there? What was the proportion of the whole European Parliament?
Well, when I took over, we had only 43 members. And when I left, I'm pleased to say that I built it up to 106. And we were getting on for 20%, getting on for one MEP in every five in Parliament.
How many MEPs are there?
Well, it's very interesting because the number is just changing. And the reason it's changing is that Croatia is joining the European Union. And we've agreed that it doesn't matter how many countries are in, there will never be more than 750 MPs. Now, that is MEPs. Now, that is slightly bigger than the House of Commons at Westminster. Not very much. But for every new country that joins after Croatia, then the numbers of each other country will be slightly reduced so that you don't have a body that's unmanageable.
Now, the European Commission is at the top of the sort of tree of power in Europe. It's the most powerful organisation, but it's totally unelected. A lot of people look at that and say, well, the whole thing is a kind of sham government. Why should we be, you know, even getting engaged? Why should we bother voting for MEPs when the most powerful part of it, the Commission, is completely unelected? Not only that, it's made up of failed politicians. A lot of them have been removed from power one way or another. I mean, for example, we had Chris Patten, who's now the chairman of the BBC Trust. He was a European Commissioner. He was removed by the voters of Bath. We also had Neil Kinnock, after he'd failed to win an election for the Labour Party here in Britain, was made a commissioner. I mean, it's not really, it doesn't really sort of sell yourself to the rest of the world, does it, by having failed politicians as your leaders?
Well, the European Commission is actually not the most powerful body. It's not a decision-making body. The decisions in the European Union are made by the two Houses of Parliament, the Council of Ministers, representing the 27 national governments, and the European Parliament, directly elected by the people of Europe. The Commission is the civil service, and people like Chris Patten and Neil Kinnock, the roles that they had is they were put in charge of civil service departments. They became, if you like, the Sir Humphreys, the Whitehall permanent secretaries. And yes, Britain does have a very bad record of putting failed politicians into these jobs, but most countries don't put failed politicians into these jobs. Most countries put people who have experience in administration and who have clear public support.
But why not make them elected?
Well, nothing against electing these people in themselves, but would you elect the permanent secretaries in Whitehall? Because that would be the equivalent. The reason you don't elect them is they don't take the decisions. The decisions are taken by the elected politicians.
But they're putting forward a lot of the legislation. A lot of people would say that they are the equivalent of the executive European system.
No, they're not. Look, the 27 government ministers decide if they need a new law. At the moment, for example, they're looking at whether we should introduce a new law on pesticides, because we've got bee colonies being destroyed by pesticides that are currently in use. And people need to protect bees, because if you can't pollinate your crops, you can't feed the people you need to feed. Now, the government environment ministers have asked the European Commission to bring forward a law, just as ministers at Westminster would ask the civil service to bring forward a law. But that's the only power the European Commission has. Of course they're powerful. Any civil service, any bureaucracy is powerful. But it's not the place where the real big decisions are taken.
Okay, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. Martin, what's your take on this business with Cyprus and the revelations this week that there are going to be loads of these natural gas contracts coming up as well? I mean, for example, Malta. Malta is in also a very bad situation financially, but it looks as if the European Central Bank haven't really bothered looking at them because they don't have the natural resources. They don't have the natural gas that the Cypriots do.
Well, it's not just about natural gas, it's about the financial system to court. I mean, let's face it, why is the Cyprus government and the Cyprus taxpayer being made to bail out their private banking system? The Icelanders took the view that the private banking system was a private banking system's concern, and they protected the Icelandic depositors in those banks. British depositors in those banks were not protected, because they took the view that because Landsbanki and ISSA were based in the City of London, it was Britain's duty to regulate them. And there's now a standoff going on between the Dutch, the British and the Icelanders over whether they're going to be prepared to pay the depositors, or, you know, like British local authorities which were using those banks. Now, that's a standoff, but the Icelanders have approached it in terms of, we're going to liquidate, we're not accepting liability for private debts. Now, of course, that is the free market position, and it's consistently argued by free market think tanks like the von Mises Institute. And of course, the reason we didn't do that, as Graham pointed out, is that there's a real danger that the whole system could just implode, and you would have a situation where ATMs don't work. People say we wouldn't get to a situation where ATMs don't work.
But they did in Cyprus.
And that's what happens if you don't bail out the banking system. But of course, once you have bailed out the banking system, you're not in Kansas anymore. The free market philosophy is finished forever. And in actual fact, we spent far more money bailing out the banking system than was ever wasted on things like subsidising the coal industry or the British transport industry and so on. Now, ultimately, we've now reached a situation where the banking fraternity has effectively, they're sitting in the room with us with a suicide vest on, saying if we don't do as they say, they're going to blow themselves up and us too. Now, this is the real problem. And of course, ultimately, the banking system will stumble. What was became clear over Cyprus is that people's deposits are not secure. And of course, if the ECB hadn't stepped in, the Troika hadn't stepped in, there could have been a run on the Cyprus banks, which would have then led to a run on other banks. And just to finish off, the reason why the Cypriot government was in problems, and the Cypriot banks were in problems, because they'd been buying Greek debt, nothing to do with the Russians. Now, in actual fact, the Russians have got big, Russian mafia have got big concerns in Cyprus. But there's a UN report on drugs and crime pointed out in 2009, the entire banking system was propped up by the drug cartels, and the drug cartels' money was sucked into the system in 2008-2009 without any questions asked. So effectively, the world's financial system is now being propped up by A, the taxpayer, B, the drug cartels. Ultimately, it will crash with chaotic consequences, because capitalism doesn't work, and that's why I'm a socialist.
Graham, there's quite a lot in there, but what's your thoughts about this But Martin's doomsday scenario there, saying that actually this debt will never be paid off, can never be paid off, that you've got criminality going on in the banks, and all the time we're trying to pay it off, we're putting off the inevitable crash.
Well, I think Martin is right about the degree of criminality in the banks and the role of the drug cartels, and that is something that the European Union has been very, very worried about, and there's been a lot of work going on to ascertain exactly where we are with the situation in the Cypriot banking system. I'm not sure I'd share his view that the whole thing is going to collapse, but I suspect Martin and I would agree that one of the reasons we're in this situation is that back in the 1980s, under people like Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, we actually changed the law to allow banks to speculate with the savings of small savers. And that had disastrous consequences. It led to the casino capitalism that we saw, which led to the collapse of Northern Rock and Lehman Brothers and the Royal Bank of Scotland. And we really have to make sure that we have proper supervision and oversight of the banks. And you know, most of the work that I've been doing over the last 3 years, and other MEPs since the financial crash, has actually been to put those supervisory authorities in place.
Now, our reporter Marina Morris has been out and about on the streets to ask you what you think of the European Union.
What do you think are the positives and negatives of the UK European Union membership?
I can't think of any reason why we should stay in there, to be honest. I think it's costing this country a lot of money. We don't get very little out of it. I agree with open markets between us, but let's stick to our own currency. Let's stick to our own rules and regulations. Their rules and regulations, their human rights is way, way too much for us. I think we should stick to our own, what we used to be.
No, I never voted for it, and I wish I'd never gone in it. No, I don't know. I'm too old now to bother about being positive at all. I shan't be here to see see the mess that's going to come up. That's about it.
I think it's important that we're part of something bigger. It's like being a member of a family. You might fall out, you might not like each other, but you're still a family. But the negatives? People don't like it because sometimes decisions are made that people are not happy with and they think it's not good for their own country. But we're such a small country, we can't manage without the others.
It's quite good because the trade can go backwards and forwards without too much trouble. And this makes, if it makes money for Bristol, it's good.
I think the support that the other countries give us and the financial stability of having a European bank and stuff is good and gives us... I think the positives outweigh the negatives.
The positives are probably trade and, yeah, trade links, and you know, obviously that's going to be good for our economy. Some of the negatives might be you have to possibly open into links with people. Might mean you can't strengthen your own economy to a certain extent, like you can't dictate certain business rates and stuff like that, maybe. I don't know a massive amount about it, so I'm not particularly informed, but that seems maybe the positive and negatives from my perspective. I think it's got to be a good thing in the long run. Yeah, I think we should stay in the European Union, yeah.
There's only negatives being in the EU, I'm sorry, in my opinion. Well, because they just want to take all our money and do as they want to, and we have to try and abide by their rules, so not happy with them. I think we're better off on our own.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
definitely staying. Well, it's a huge market for us. And also, I feel more like a European now than I did when I was younger.
That was you and your opinions very much divided there about the EU. And Graham Watson is with me, Lib Dem MEP. Graham, what do you think there? I mean, essentially what they're saying is there's a divided opinion. But if we look at those who are against the EU, they're saying, look, this is some kind of distant big brother. We don't want anything to do with this United States of Europe.
Well, the public opinion is very divided. You might remember that wonderful old Adge Cutler track, when the common market comes to Stanton Drew. You know, people, they know that something's changing and they fear change. And I think that the trouble in this country is that people have been fed a diet of anti-European propaganda by newspapers owned by an Australian-American called Rupert Murdoch, who has an agenda to get Britain out. The reality is that the European Union has given us all kinds of things that we wouldn't have had. It's given us cleaner beaches, cleaner rivers, cleaner air, lead-free petrol. It's given us cheaper mobile phone rates. It's given us cheaper air travel. It's given us much better product safety.
What about the euro, Graham?
Well, what about the euro? We're not part of the euro. But
are you saying
think
that this whole euro crisis has really nothing to do with the EU? It would have happened anyway in all these separate countries.
No, well, certainly it would have done. And we have a sterling crisis at the moment, and because our debt as a percentage of our wealth is actually higher than the average in the European Union. So we have as big a problem as the eurozone. We've all got to deal with the problem of having too much debt, and that's why the government is having to make cuts to public services and having to raise taxes. But that's happening in every country in Europe. It's not the euro that's at fault, it's the fact that we had irresponsible management of our national finances for many years, and not just in this country, in Greece, in Portugal, in Ireland as well.
Now, Martin, is this euro crisis? Would it happen if everyone still had all their separate currencies?
Yes, because it's a crisis within the financial system. So what we've got is a situation like the molten magma moving beneath the Earth's crust, looking for weak spots. So the euro is a potential weak spot. Cyprus is a very weak spot. Britain could be a weak spot. There's no easy solution to this.
But Greece can't, for example, create its own money anymore, can it? It's got to go to Frankfurt.
Yes, Britain is... we've got more room for manoeuvre than if we were in the euro, and I'm glad that we're not in the euro, but we're not taking it. And this idea that we've got to cut because the government... in Spain, for example, there was no massive public deficit. There wasn't really a big public deficit here either. Bailing the banks out has been more expensive than anything government has done for a generation. Now, we may agree that we had to do that and there was no choice, although I think the jury's out on that, but... that's why the governments have got no money. It's because they bailed the banks out. But the banks then turn around with... it's not moral hazard. It's what Milton Friedman used to call regulatory capture or whatever. The banks get bailed out and then they keep coming back for more. And that used to be the argument against bailing out nationalised industries. So if we bail out the shipbuilding industry, we'll be back next year for more. The banks have been bailed out, and they're back for more and more and more. And ultimately, nothing has been done. There's not been a willingness on the part of the political class to discipline the financial class. And that's because the financial class pay for the politics. Obama's election, for example, was paid for by Wall Street.
Martin, this is exactly why we've just done two things at European level I think are very important. One is we have legislated to stop the banks paying their staff massive bonuses indeed at the end of every year. And the next thing that we're doing, and the finance ministers are discussing it quite possibly right at this very moment because they're meeting in Dublin, they're discussing the requirement for a bail-in. In other words, the banks are going to have to set up a fund into which they pay so that if ever they go bankrupt again, it's not the taxpayer who picks up the tab.
I agree with that in principle, but it's like stable door horse bolted, I'm afraid. The regulation of the banking system should have been in place.
It wasn't in place.
And now having a sort of fantasy game of what we would put in place if the situation wasn't as it is in a way irrelevant because I'm afraid the situation is getting out of control.
Okay, Martin, you mentioned Milton Friedman. That sort of brings us on to Margaret Thatcher, doesn't it? Because she was a great admirer of him as an economist. Who was he and what was that all about?
Well, he's at the University of Chicago, and when I was learning economics in the late 70s, he was regarded as a bit of a crank, somebody that not to be taken seriously. And I remember the 230-odd economists who wrote the open letter in the Times to Margaret Thatcher saying, don't do this, it's silly. But of course what's happened in the interim is Milton Friedman's ideas and the Chicago School ideas have become the mainstream. They were always wrong. They're still wrong, and they've got an awful lot to do to explain
why.
Am
I right in thinking, Mr. Blanchflower, your friend wrote a letter about a week ago with a load of other economists' friends to reiterate what he'd said back in 2010 about George Osborne and his austerity policy being a disaster?
The problem with austerity is that it doesn't, in fact, lead to debt repayment. It actually makes the situation worse. And the problem is that the banks are insisting on austerity, but that then leads to a situation where they're not going to be paid. At that point, they have a nervous breakdown and collapse, unless they're propped up by the state. Now, at the moment, there's a kind of conjuring act going on where the ECB and Mario Draghi were saying that they would back up.
This is the European Central Bank.
And George Soros in Frankfurt this week was saying, well, the Germans either should agree to euro bonds or themselves leave the euro and go back to the Deutschmark. The problem with any of these movements, with any movement at all in this situation, could bring on a crash. And I think there will be a crash because there's so many different ways in which a crash could occur. Simple miscalculation in some small place like Cyprus can lead to a massive knock-on effect, which is why we shouldn't have a system that is so fragile. We need something more robust. Ultimately, I think we're going to have public banking as a public utility.
What do you think about that, Graham?
Well, I mean, there is, of course, a danger that if you have still a culture of speculation, and it is still there, and I don't think the bankers have actually understood the degree of public outrage over what happened, if you have there is always a danger. It is the job of government to try to prevent that happening, and much of our attention at the moment in the European Parliament and the Council of Ministers is geared towards that. But, you know, I'm delighted to see things like the success of the Bristol pound as a local currency, because this is people deciding they can do these things for themselves. They don't always need to go to the big ones, and I understand the Bristol pound is now up to having something like £100,000 of notes in circulation or in savings or whatever.
But what about the point that Martin was making right there, which was about having banking as a utility? I mean, we used to have various utilities, didn't we? Electricity, gas, telecoms, things like the buses, all these basic things that everybody needs, and everyone knows that if you privatise them, they tend to end up as a cartel with people profiteering. What about doing that with the banking sector? I mean, that's surely a pretty radical solution in Europe, but it's a possible one.
There has certainly been cartels in banking, and one of the problems we had after the Financial Services Act in 1986 is that all of these regulatory bodies that were supposed to be regulating the banks and stopping these cartels didn't work. They were all staffed by people from within the system. They didn't do the job that they were supposed to do, which watchdogs are supposed to do, which is bark when something goes wrong, and it reached the stage where the whole things started to collapse.
Well, at the moment, we've got this crazy situation with the private banks running themselves for private profit, doing things like, I mean, they can even bet on food crises. You know, they're making money from people starving. They make money from war. What about the EU actually intervening and saying, well, actually, we're going to take you over because we don't think you're being run very well? That's essentially what Martin was saying. The banking should be a utility which serves the European public.
Look, the trouble is, any industry is working on the basis of making profits. Banking in that sense is no different from any other. And I don't believe that the case for nationalising the banks is a strong one any more than I believe the case for nationalising other industries is a strong one. But what government has to do, and this is where this goes back to Adam Smith, and Martin will know this as an economist, what governments have to do is to recognise that markets, left to their own devices, don't work. Capitalism doesn't work. What you have to do is to have strong government to oversee and regulate the way in which companies trade with each other on markets. And Adam Smith wrote that in his first book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, back in probably 1776.
Martin, it's a non-starter, mate.
No, well, I mean, this is why I'm a socialist rather than a liberal, because in actual fact, I think if you look at the way Western economies, including the British economy, were managed from 1945 to the mid-70s, there was what we would call a mixed economy, where, you know, about 50% of things were run by the state and 50% of things were run by the private sector. And of course, it's actually a technical question. If you've got a very competitive market with lots of suppliers, then you have a free market. If you haven't, and of course, cartels are inevitable in certain industries because of the scale of production. You can't have that many people producing aircraft, for example.
Well, I suppose the reason I'm a liberal rather than a socialist is because I look at the 50% of things that were run by the state and I remember how awfully badly they were run.
Well, I look across the North Sea to Norway, and I look at Statoil, which has provided a massive sovereign wealth fund controlled by the Norwegian government, which will be producing nursery schools and pensions for the next 50 or 60 years for the people of Norway. Statoil, without doubt, one of the best managed publicly run companies in the world. And of course, people in Scotland are looking across there and saying, we could have done that,
but we did, because we did it by taxing the private oil companies who exploited North Sea oil, and those tax revenues, well, you and I would agree, they should have been invested exactly the way the Norwegians do them, in schools and hospitals, and actually they were spent on some pretty...
I think there'd be Martin, there'd be people who would disagree with you, Graham, who travel backwards and forwards to London on the train about privatisation and about whether the old British Rail was run very well, because now the trains are massively overcrowded. And it's like squeezing people into sardine tins.
They're overcrowded and they're overpriced, but they run on time generally, which they never did before.
So it doesn't matter that people are having to...
They've got three times the public subsidy that they had under public ownership.
The people are paying large sums to sit on these trains, but there ain't a seat for them, is there?
Look, I could argue with you all day about the railways. I don't think the way railways run today is great. All I'm saying is that my recollection of the railways in the 1970s was not any better than the service you get on the railways today. We have failed as a country to invest, whether under public ownership or under private ownership, in the kind of quality of track and rail services that we need. And if you look, for example, just over the channel at France, and you look at their wonderful high-speed TGV system, you think, how is it the French could do this and we didn't? It's not to do with the ownership, it's to do with the management.
Well, it is publicly owned in France, though, as you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the point is that publicly run industries can be disastrously mismanaged, as we saw in Eastern Europe, or they can be managed properly by people who know what they're doing, as we've seen in Norway.
It's
actually dogmatic. It's a question of, as you say, management. If they're any good, they'll manage it properly, and if they're no good, they're no good.
I think the point being, you know, do we want massive profits being taken out and a cartel being set up? That's ultimately, the thing that bothers me. Arrests and injuries, anyway, at Bristol's Margaret Thatcher Street Party. This is the Bristol Post on Tuesday. Police officer injured in last night's disturbances has now been discharged. discharged from hospital after sustaining a neck injury. Bristol made it onto the international news on Tuesday for having one of the biggest parties, or at least the biggest necessity for a police intervention. People were partying in the street in Easton at 12:30, and imagine that the police decided people are phoning in to complain because they couldn't sleep. And it would have been nice, wouldn't it, if there had been somewhere else for people to go and party that wasn't disturbing people, and there was a bit of a clash with the police. But what are your thoughts about this, Graham, as to whether it's appropriate to have a party to celebrate the death of Margaret Thatcher?
Well, Mrs. Thatcher was a very, very controversial character. And I'm torn between shock and outrage at some of the things she did, and a kind of admiration for the fact that an outsider could come in, take over the Conservative Party, get into government, and impose their will on the country. I admire her for her achievements, even if I abhor the philosophy that she professed and some of the things that she did. But I do think that it is in bad taste to go and party on anybody's death, whether it is the death of a right-wing leader or a left-wing leader, whether it's the death of a Democrat or a totalitarian person.
Martin?
Well, I mean, I think the saddest thing about this is it ended with problems and difficulties. I mean, I live in Easton, and if people had gone home quietly at midnight, I don't suppose there would have been much of a bother. And I think that's the issue there for people in Bristol. People have got a right to express themselves, whatever people think, and as long as they do it reasonably and go home in good order, then there shouldn't be any problem.
Well, they don't have to go home, do they? They can go somewhere else, yes. where they're not in a street.
I mean, the pub, the Chelsea outside, I go in there quite frequently, and the neighbours, by and large, they get on with the people who go in the pub. But if you're going to make a racket all night, then you're going to annoy people, aren't you?
Well, street parties do work. I mean, I remember when I was living in Oxford in County Road, we had a party that went on all afternoon, started about midday and right into the evening about midnight, with just two police at one end and two police at the other end. The buses had to go round some of the side roads, but that was about the biggest problem.
People will tolerate that, provided people go home at a reasonable hour.
MP Stephen Williams snubbed this week's common debate on Margaret Thatcher. He's in your party.
He is indeed, and Steve Williams is somebody for whom I have a lot of respect and who feels very, very strongly, particularly coming from South Wales originally, as he does, at what Mrs. Thatcher did to this country, and particularly what she did to the trade unions. I wouldn't have snubbed the debate in the way that Stephen did, but I know that he did it out of very, very deep-seated principle, and that I respect.
Martin, should Stephen Williams have gone?
Well, I mean, there's a question why. I mean, John Burkhoff, the Speaker of the House, did in fact question whether the Parliament should be recalled at all, because don't forget, that's going to cost quite a lot of money to recall Parliament for this Thatcher Fest. And at a time when we're cutting everything, we can find money for this. And apparently there's going to be millions spent on the funeral next week taxpayer.
About £10 million, yeah.
Well, I think perhaps we should go out and ask the Vox Pops in Bristol, how much do you think Margaret Thatcher's funeral is worth £10 million of your money? And the answer might very well be no.
What about next week's funeral then, Martin? What are your thoughts about, I mean, is it going to pass off peacefully? Because there's a lot of people, I mean, particularly on Saturday, for example, it looks like there's going to be a big party in Trafalgar Square in London, possibly parties here in Bristol too. What are your thoughts about whether that's appropriate for people to go and poop the funeral?
People can do whatever they like as long as they do it within the law and respect their neighbours. I mean, people are entitled to their opinions. Of course they are.
Well, yes, people are entitled to their opinions, and that's the way it's going to be. Look, she is a person who will, for many years, continue to be a figure who is very divisive. But I think what is important is that we use this time to re-examine many of the things that have happened in the time she was Prime Minister, mm-hmm. and to look at some of the changes in attitude and policy she brought about, and ask ourselves whether really this is the kind of society we want. And I think probably this will start a process of reflection which may well turn people away from these Friedmanite ideas that Martin was talking about earlier.
Okay, before we leave Margaret Thatcher in this first hour, let's hear what you have to say about it. Marina Morris has been out in the streets asking you your thoughts about the legacy of Margaret Thatcher.
Margaret Thatcher, was she good for the country?
No, simple answer. Working people like myself suffered badly through her. You know, my condolences to her family, but she was not for me. I couldn't afford to live under her, to be honest. I struggled big time. She cost us a lot of money. Seemed to be the old thing in this country with the Conservatives, etc. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And I think that was her personified.
Half and half. She did an awful lot of bad things for the working people. Let's take the miners, motor industry and stuff like that. But another thing she did, she was one woman with guts who stood up and did what she thought. At the moment, we've got nobody with the guts that Margaret Thatcher.
No, she wasn't. I mean, I was around when she was in power. All my children grew up when she was in power. She was a bad woman. She changed the way that people thought about each other. Everybody had to fight everybody else for jobs, for housing. And it changed, I think, the way that we as a nation think. We're more selfish now. And we think we don't care about other people. We just think as long as we're all right, that's all that matters. I think that's she started that, really.
My opinion of her could not be broadcast. Margaret Thatcher, milk snatcher.
I think she did a very controversial sort of term in Prime Minister, and I think she didn't look out for the working class and concentrated on supporting the upper class.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe for the time she was a good leader, but now it might be looked back as, you know, a bit big dictatorship sort of. I think maybe at the time she was what the country needed, yeah.
Yes, I think she was. The country was in a hell of a state when she came in, and she did what she thought was right, and there's a lot of people have got a lot of things today that they wouldn't have had she have not come in, like a house.
From Italy. Was not very good, the image. But I don't know her. I was not very interested in Margaret.
Selfish and
getting on for themselves and not thinking about the whole
community.
Yeah, that's a shame.
Yes. Now, what about this idea, Graham Watson, the fact that we now have to fight for jobs and fight for housing? I mean, I can remember, this is one of the things, I can remember almost as soon as Margaret Thatcher came in, seeing people for the first time, homeless people appearing on the streets in London. It was considered one of the fundamental jobs of society to look after people without a home. With Thatcher, there was an end to that.
Well, there was, and the fact is we have failed to invest what we've needed to invest in our housing stock for a long, long time. Think back to the end of the First World War and that great campaign of Homes Fit for Heroes. Well, it was a great political slogan, but sadly no government really invested properly in it, as a result of which, among Western European countries, we have some of the worst public housing that is there. And although a lot of investment came in, private investment, by people who bought their houses under the reforms that Mrs. Thatcher introduced, we never invested enough in providing for the next generation of people.
Well, that's right. I think the two major economic failures of the Thatcher regime and the follow-on was A, the housing problem, because it's fundamental. I mean, we have property bubbles here. They don't have them in other parts of Europe. What do you do when you get a property bubble? The Germans go, what property bubble? We don't have them. The other thing, of course, is the deregulation of the banking system, which allowed some people to get very, very wealthy, and, of course, has turned out to be disastrous. It, on balance, when the history books come to be written, it might be regarded that the City of London, on balance, is something that's actually been bad for the British economy.
Well, bang up to date, this week in the Mirror, welfare cuts will widen inequality and suck £19 billion a year out of the economy, a report reveals. Northern families will be hit hardest, and wealthy southern areas will be spared most pain, says the Sheffield Hallam University study. The government's benefits raid will suck £19 billion a year out of the UK economy, and, as I say, northern families to be hit hardest. Blackpool will lose out more than anywhere. Former industrial areas such as Middlesbrough, Liverpool and Glasgow will also be badly hit. Now, they've come up with a little chart in the Mirror. Sheffield Hallam University have, anyway, with the average amount every working age adult stands to lose each year, which is varying around about £700-600. I think it's, yes, Blackpool is the worst, losing £910 a year. The South West, they mentioned Torbay, where every working age adult stands to lose £700 a year, Graham.
Well, Look, the real problem that we have, and this is a problem that we're not the only society to face, is that a lot of people have become a lot wealthier than their parents were. But we have about 15% of the total population at the very bottom end who are in a more desperate situation than they've ever been, partly because the differential between their status, the difference between their income and the income of the people at the middle or the top of the pile, is so much greater. And this is why Nick Clegg, I think, is absolutely right to say that the government has to try once and for all to deal with their situation. That's why we're putting a lot of money into the education of the very of children from the very poorest families. It's why we're putting a lot of money into health in certain of our northern cities. It's why we're trying to cut the tax paid by the lowest paid in society. And I think that as of the 1st of April, we've now taken some 20 million people reduced their tax bills very substantially, and we've taken a very large number out of tax altogether. But
many of the people here, though, I mean, the lowest paid are also going to be losing benefits too, aren't they? Because most of the lowest paid people are also having to top up their incomes with benefits.
Well, the idea of what we're trying to do with the tax system is to cut people's taxes so that they can take home more of the pay that they get. Now, of course, that does mean there's going to be a differential between them and the people who live on benefits, the people who can't find work or who are unfit for work, and that is a problem society has to tackle. Yeah,
Martin, in the northwest, northeastern Yorkshire, they will be losing a total of £5.2 billion a year in benefit income. That's out of that total of nearly £20 billion.
Yeah, but the point is, from a macroeconomic point of view, I don't believe that there is a case at all for cutting welfare spending. And in actual fact, in Iceland, which is a much more flexible system than ours because it's a smaller country, they've actually increased unemployment benefits as part of the radical measures adopted by their new government there. Ultimately, chopping demand out of the economy does not do anything to solve the problem we're in. Keeping the level of public expenditure up doesn't solve the problem either, because the banking system is shot away and was potentially going to collapse. But cutting public expenditure, and this is true in Britain, it's true of what Germany's trying to force on southern Europe, it simply won't work. It was the great liberal economist Keynes who pointed this out in the 1930s. And as he said in the 1930s, it's a logical point, not a political point. Debts that can't be paid won't be paid. And ultimately, we're kidding ourselves that the bondholders in the banks and the shareholders can get 100% of everything that they've gambled. That is not on, it can't work, and it's bound to fail.
A secret law storm as the police chiefs ban the public from knowing who they arrest. A shock new blanket ban in the wake of the Leveson report angers civil liberty groups who condemn the threat to democracy. This is in the Mail on Sunday, I think this was. Under new ACPO guidance, forces are to be banned from naming suspects. The legal risk of incorrect identification will stop the media from naming suspects. Police plan for secret arrests is opposed by the Law Commission. Now, what's your view on this, Graham Watson?
Well, I think this is a proposed new guidance. I don't think it's actually come in yet. I'm sure that when it gets debated in Parliament, it will get changed.
Well, under the new guidance, apparently some forces are already implementing this.
Well, if that's the case, then I'm sure that there will be a debate in Parliament very soon, because one of the things that we treasure quite rightly in this country is the control that we have over the police forces. There have been cases where this has got out of hand. We know as a result of the phone hacking scandals, indeed, all of the things that lead to inquiries like the Leveson inquiry being set up, we know that we need better control to make sure that people's individual rights and dignity are upheld. And I'm actually very pleased that Liberal Democrats are finding the Conservatives quite easy to work with on this. There is a recognition across the whole of the coalition that individuals' rights have to be guaranteed.
Martin, it's Chris Jeffries in Bristol, who was apparently was named by the Daily Mail and other newspapers as potentially the murderer in the Joe Yates case. That's they're saying, well, now we shouldn't really be naming people. But of course he is, I believe, still suing Avon and Somerset Police, saying that actually what they did is they didn't just name him, that they told the newspapers, and this is his allegation, that he'd done it.
Yeah, well, that was wrong, and of course that's why he's suing them. I mean, the police, I think, are entitled to say we've arrested so-and-so on suspicion of whatever, but they're innocent till proven guilty.
Well, the point here is that the media are approaching the police and say, we believe you arrested this person, and can you confirm it or deny it? And the police are now starting to say, no, we can't tell you anything.
Well, I think there will be questions about whether that's justice has to be public. I'm opposed to secret courts as well, which is the other thing that's coming forward. Justice has to be public and be seen to be done.
And the other thing, of course, is it doesn't leave any kind of audit trail, does it? If the police have arrested someone wrongly, well, it's not actually, that information wasn't in the public domain. You can't go back and say, well, was this person wrongly arrested or not?
The balance between liberty and security is one of the most difficult things that any government in the modern age has to strike. Why? Firstly, because you have, thankfully, a very active and inquisitive media. Secondly, because electronic technology is giving us far more access to things. And transparency is a good thing. I mean, sunlight is the best disinfectant. But government has to be able to act to protect people in certain circumstances from certain things. But, you know, let's make sure that we have a cross-party consensus on this, because that is what is needed for effective government.
At the moment, I'm afraid, Graham, there's chaos with some police forces implementing it and others not. Anyway, on to our next story. The Severn Barrage. Two project founders were declared bankrupt in the past. This is an investigation by BBC Wales, which doesn't seem to have managed to make it across the Bristol Channel. The barrage would run from the Vale of Glamorgan to the Somerset coast. Serious questions about two of the founders of a project to build a barrage across the Severn Estuary were raised by a BBC investigation. The largest shareholder in Hafren Power has previously been declared bankrupt three times during a lengthy business career. Another businessman was declared bankrupt twice, but said it shouldn't detract from the project's legitimacy.
Well, I'm somebody who's actually always favoured tapping into the energy potential of the tides in the River Severn. And I have at times in the past thought a barrage would be a good idea. But actually, I met the people from Hafren Power. I didn't like them. I didn't like the nature of their proposal. I think the best option at the moment on the table in terms of sustainability is actually the idea that's been put forward and endorsed by people like Friends of the Earth to have a series of tidal lagoons in the estuary. You could possibly do the same with what's being called a tidal reef much lower down. The fact is that we don't need to be investing in fracking in the Mendips or in new oil and gas resources. We don't need to be investing in new nuclear if we exploit all of the potential that's there from renewable sources. And the River Severn has huge potential. Let's do it, but let's make sure we get it right, and it's not going to be pouring thousands of tons of concrete into a barrage across that part.
Bristol Greenpeace groups arranged a public meeting to discover what the mega barrage and the tidal lagoon proposals consist of at 7:30 on Monday. That's this coming Monday, the 15th of April, at the library, the Quaker Meeting House, 126 Hampton Road, Bristol. Martin, what's your thoughts about these characters who have put forward this barrage?
Well, that's the first I've heard of it, but I think the point I would make about on energy is that the biggest the thing that we really need to do is energy efficiency. So we're arguing all the time about where we're going to get new energy from. The technology of energy efficiency is already there. In Germany, all new housing has to be built to a zero emissions standard. We are still throwing up jerry-built Barrett homes.
On to our sort of ongoing story, which is a sort of minor irksome complaint, really, about the appointment of Matt Payne, who is an employee of KPMG, who's a close advisor to George Ferguson, the mayor of Bristol, for free. He's a volunteer. KPMG, his employers, are facing a possible audit inquiry over the failure of HBOS. Although the big four accounting firms were not criticised by the Parliamentary Commission on Banking Standards, the damning report has revealed that HBOS was carrying £47 billion worth of losses when rescued by the taxpayer, despite getting a clean bill of health from KPMG.
Well, I mean, we just got to keep an eye on this. I mean, George Ferguson is
£47 billion of losses that they didn't spot.
Yes, and if George Ferguson is using this chap as one of his advisers, then that's something that people like us are going to keep an eye on, isn't it?
Now, we don't often, come across these firms, Graham, do we? These financial services firms, KPMG, don't seem like they've done a very good job, do they, on the accounts of HBOS?
I think there are big questions to be asked about all of the big audit firms and the rather too cosy relationships that they have with banks or some of the big companies that they audit. You know, there's a proposal out at the moment that you should have to change your audit firm every 3 or 4 years. I don't know whether that is exactly the right recipe, but I do believe that you shouldn't have one audit firm auditing one company over a long period of time and perhaps not being quite as critical or quite as investigative as it should be. After all, many of these are publicly quoted companies, and the shareholders need to know whether they are indeed being properly managed.
Okay, finally, give Charles's duchy money to Cornwall's serfs. A Labour peer is demanding Prince Charles hand over the wealth, the Duchy of Cornwall, to the county's residents. Just a word from you both on that one.
Well, should the Prince of Wales hand over the money? I would say that's up to him.
Well, I mean, the question of who gets what in society is definitely being raised by this crisis, and that's probably the only positive thing about it.
OK, we're coming up now to the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Liberal Democrat MEP for the South West of England, Sir Graham Watson. After the news, Bristol tops international news bulletins. We have a look at Margaret Thatcher.
Bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.